I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.
Yeah, we went to Chuck E. Cheese today.
Nice.
Yeah.
Saw that bonfire you were getting. Wait, there's still Chuck E. Cheese's?
They redid this Chuck E. Cheese, too. It was, like, totally revamped. They closed it for a few weeks to like, refurbish it and everything like that. And because all the Chuck E. Cheese's are taking out the animatronics, you know, those awful, horrifying, nightmare-inducing animatronic animals on stage that pretend to play music and can hear the gears grind
right.
and go whirring and stuff. It's a Chuck E. Cheese staple. I mean,
yeah, the only thing that would make me go to one.
Yes,
anymore.
Yes, precisely. They've been replaced by a panel of televisions in the middle of the room featuring a cartoon Chuck E. Cheese playing all the time.
This stupid country.
It's a betrayal of our youth. It really is. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. We went in there but yes, there are still Chuck E. Cheese's, and it was actually we kind of went for a combination of my father and my father-in-law's I think he's like 68 or 69th birthday. So it wasn't my idea, but we went to Chuck E. Cheese for his birthday.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's
it wasn't
what he wanted
his decision
to do.
Either. No, it wasn't his decision either. I'm not sure how we reached this decision. I'll be honest with you. I'm not sure how we got to Chuck E. Cheese, but that was my late Sunday afternoon. A Chuck E. Cheese in Prince William County, Virginia. It was interesting. I'll say that.
Well, I assume that's the crown jewel of the Chuck E. Cheese empire.
Really, when they look to the Chuck E. Cheese that they want to put out there to the rest of the country, it's probably the one. It's probably the one. It's so good.
Playing a long drive! There it is! Number 500! The career 500th home run for Michael Jack Smith!
Oh, yes! Slides. Rollins has won it! They stream out of the dugout!
Yeah.
Rollins by near third! This game is over!
It is out of here! 50th home run of the year for Ryan Howard!
Ruiz out to get it. The throw from his knees. It's in time! And it's a no-hitter! Unbelievable! Ruiz and Howard!
Oh, Chase is going to keep going, and he's safe at home plate!
Wow.
Chase Utley, you are the man! Swing and a miss! Struck him out! The Philadelphia Phillies are 2008 World Champions of Baseball!
Now batting for the Phillies, second baseman John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 222. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight and NumberFire.com. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. And joining me, as he does every Sunday night, is the managing editor for The Good Fight, the great Justin Clue. You can follow Justin on Twitter at Justin_Clue. Hey, Justin, how you doing, buddy?
Wow. We're still saying the managing editor thing. I really need to go over and check that website to make sure it's not on fire.
Yeah, just, you know, pop your head in to make sure that the
yes.
the kids haven't squirted gasoline around the
Show
room and aren't playing
you know.
With matches. Yeah.
Things an editor does.
Hey, guys, it's your managing editor. I just thought I'd say hey and introduce myself. I've known you guys for a while, but we've never really
talked. Do things still happen
yeah,
when I'm not looking at the internet? I didn't realize.
Oh, no, okay. No, it all Thank shuts down. It
appreciate
all shuts
that.
Down. You're fine. Yeah. Yeah, no, as you've probably heard, obviously Justin is our good leader at The Good Fight, as Liz has now moved on as a full-time writer for Yahoo Sports. And Liz is a little under the weather tonight, so she won't be joining us on this edition of Hittin' Season, so it'll be just Justin and me. And,
you don't have to be,
it's really kind
be
of
kind,
interesting.
John. There's a regime change. Certain
Thank God.
Decisions
Thank
were
God.
Made regarding who
yeah.
is on this podcast, and, you know, mm-hmm. certain people mm-hmm. were... muscled out, you might say, by those of us who have achieved new forms of power. So that's kind of there's a new yeah. structure. So get used to it.
It's you know what? the bloodthirstiness that I was not expecting. You know, it wasn't there when we were working for that other website together. You know, when you were running that site and I was one of your little underlings, and you know, I was still a baby blogger, and you were running the show. Now we've both moved on, and we're both doing the same thing now at the Good Fight. It feels like home again. And the great thing is that Liz is going to be around, and she's going to be doing the podcast and all that stuff. But it was necessary for us to shove her out of the way here. I agree with you. You know, it's just
She was becoming too powerful and had to be dealt with.
That's what it was. No, we hope Liz gets better. Just she's dealing with a little bit of a cold, and so we will obviously be talking to her in the middle of the week when you and her do your next episode of Continued Success. Which, by the way, the Continued Success episodes, guys, if you haven't been catching them, they are must listen tos right now, because we're getting into the good stuff with 2008, 1993, reminiscing about the playoffs and the heroes and the big hits and the pitching, you know, the pitching heroics that were in some of those series. Man, this is kind of the reason you guys did it all year, was to get to this point where you can actually focus on the really fun stuff from 2008 and 1993, especially since this Phillies team, the 2018 Phillies team, didn't make the playoffs. So the last one you guys did was about games 1 and 2 of the 1993 National League Championship Series, and I imagine you guys will be getting into some of the 2008 stuff here this week, and a little bit more of the 93 stuff as we're moving into deep into the National League and American League Championship Series here in real time.
Yeah, it's been interesting to structure the last month, because as we said on the podcast, this is kind of the territory where everyone remembers what happened. They don't really need to be reminded or told things maybe they weren't aware of from the regular season, which was full of information and anecdotes and fun little tidbits. But this is obviously, this is the stuff that makes it onto all the highlight reels. This last week was the 93 NLCS games 1 and 2, and we'll figure out a way to finish that up and get into the World Series. It's just hilarious because there's so many differences, not just in between the baseball we're watching from those two eras and baseball now, but just, I don't know, between those two eras themselves. Like, I'm watching footage from the 1993 NLCS, and there was one of the Otis Nixon tried to steal a base, and Darren Dalton threw him out. And I was just like, I realized I was sitting there waiting for them to like challenge the call. And I was like, oh wait, that's kind of an interesting topic. Like, always somebody who's like, oh yeah, no, there's definitely certain cases, like umpires blow the call, we need certain cases where replay can like correct it. And in that case, it was just like, wow, you know, when you were on the right side of a call back before there was replay, and it was just like, you knew it was final, they made the call and that was it, you were honestly very, very relieved. Like, it was, those guys can argue all they want, it's not going to change. You know, there was some beauty in that.
No, absolutely. No. And I, you know, and we'll get into some of the, current stuff in just a second, but I remember that Don Denkinger call. I don't know if you remember that game. This was the first World Series, really the first big sporting event I ever watched as a kid. I think I was 9 or 10. I don't remember. It was 1985 World Series, with the Royals and the Cardinals. And, It was game 6 where that famous Don Denkinger blown call at first base, where I think the Cardinals, if I'm not mistaken, it was the Cardinals were like 2 outs away, or maybe it was the first out of the inning they were trying to get, but I think they were 2 outs away from winning the World Series, and Denkinger, who was the first base umpire in that game, blows a call on a play where the first baseman was throwing to the pitcher covering first, and the runner was out, clearly out. I mean, it wasn't even close. You could see it on the replay. It was an enormously blown call, and it ended up costing the Cardinals the game. The Royals came back on to score 2 runs in the bottom of the ninth to win that game 6-2-1, and then they blew out the Cardinals the next night. And I think that was game 7 where Joaquin Andujar like absolutely lost his mind screaming at the umpires after he got knocked out like in the second inning or whatever it was. And I remember all of it so clearly as a 9-year-old. I was like, yeah, this is awesome. Like, I want to inject this into my veins. This is fantastic. It was the first time my parents had ever let me stay up late to watch anything either, like 11 o'clock or midnight or whatever it was. So that's when I fell in love with the World Series and the Major League playoffs. And if they had replay back then, none of that happens.
Yeah.
They go back to New York and they put the headsets on. You know, you see Whitey Herzog come running out of the mound with his little hands over his ears, you know, like put on the cans, running, and they go up to New York and they call, and then they walk over out. The Cardinals need one more out, and they probably win that 1985 World Series, and all that excitement goes away. I'm not saying that replay is bad, because obviously the idea is to get it right. And Don Dengager got death threats after that game. You know, he got all kinds of stuff. And we're going to talk about the umpiring so far in the 2018 playoffs here coming up in just a few minutes. But replay definitely can save some umpires some death threats by getting some really big, important calls, right? Because, no joke, he received death threats from St. Louis fans. There's no kidding around. It was nasty.
I mean, Mitch Williams received death threats from Phillies fans.
Yes, he did.
I'm kind of scaring myself a little bit, because these are all things that I was advocating for, sort of not the total takeover of technology of baseball, but just more modernized aspects of it. And now I'm doing this and like talking all year about Gabe Kapler and analytics, and then this kind of instance, and I'm just finding myself like, I'm still, I don't know, I want to be healthily in the middle, but I do feel like, yeah, obviously there was some joy to be gleaned from watching your team get the call, but also in watching a team you hated get absolutely screwed. It just, you know, when you're a very passionate fan, sometimes it can feel like the bad teams never get screwed, and the good teams always do. Right. I remember thinking a couple of years ago, the playoff series between the Yankees and Yankees and Twins, and Joe Mauer hit like a line drive down the left field line, and it landed like a foot and a half fair that they didn't see until the replay, and the announcer had to be like, "Oh, that was a fair ball, by the way," and the Twins just didn't get that call. Then the Yankees, of course, beat them. Like,
yeah, yeah. That's how it was, man. It was just like, you know, tough crap, eat it. Yep. You know what I mean? You just had to swallow it back in those days. So, yeah, and it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I guess it was 2009, because it was 2009 was the first year they used replay because of the Alex Rodriguez home run in the World Series. Again, in Game 3 in Philadelphia, he hit that ball that hit, I think it was, what, did it hit off the camera or something in right field, or hit off of something in right field, and they had to review. It was the first home run review, and this is, I think, when they only reviewed home runs. I think this is before they had review for outs on the bases. Didn't they start off just reviewing?
It started
with
home runs. Yeah, that was an early version of all this.
Yeah. So this wasn't that long ago that we've been doing this, less than a decade since we've had replay in baseball. But if it can help the umpires well, let's jump into the umpiring. I had this listed in a different order, but since we've kind of gone in this direction, one of the things I think we've noticed during the course of the year is we've seen the same old bad umpires, Justin, continue to do the same old bad job. We know Angel Hernandez sucks. We know C.B. Buckner sucks. We know Joe West. Maybe Joe West isn't the worst, like, balls and strikes umpire as far as, like, incompetence in doing his job, but he's an arrogant ass and makes the game about himself much of the time, to the point where you want him gone, too. And in Game 1 of the American League Championship Series, Boston manager Alex Cora was ejected for arguing balls and strikes because James Hoy, an umpire I've never heard of before, was umpiring behind home plate and was having a horrible night behind the plate. It was incompetence. I mean, there's no other way around it. And Paul Gammons, I don't know if you've been following Paul Gammons lately on Twitter, but he's been tweeting fire lately. I don't know what got into him.
He's been absolutely you're absolutely right.
Something got into him. Something got into Peter Gammons, because he's been a pissed off man lately, and I don't hate it necessarily, because, you know, Peter is usually on the side of the Angels here, and I think he is on this part as well. He tweeted, "MLB and minor leagues make record profits but put nothing into developing umpires, and then when bad ones make 5 innings, 2-hour affairs, blame players for the pace." And I think, you know, that's probably in a lot of ways true, you know? I mean, I don't know exactly what he's getting at as far as the pace and the umpires being a reason for the slow pace of play, but just in general, umpires, you know, it's a tough job. I get it. It's not easy to call balls and strikes. Pitchers are throwing harder than ever. They're throwing crazier breaking stuff than ever. I don't know who the pitcher was who was throwing it, because I wasn't able to catch much of Game 1, but I did see the replay of this one pitch that obviously this pitcher crossed up the catcher, and I think it was was it Verlander? I don't remember who it was, but it was a curveball that was right down the middle of the plate. I mean, right down the heart of the plate, but the catcher stood up and then crouched back down to catch it. And
I believe it was Joe Kelly of the Red Sox. I remember watching that pitch because he was pitching some – he was just cracking the whip with that with the movement on the edge of that pitch, and he was super locked in. There was a point where he went into his windup and hadn't realized until he was all the way through it that the batter had stepped out of the box and called timeout. And yeah, there was, he threw a pitch that fooled the umpire. They're like, the catcher didn't help by like jumping to his feet like that, but it was exactly down the middle of the plate. And it was absolutely a strike in an inning where, I almost wrote about that inning for Baseball Prospectus, but then coincidentally enough, wound up writing about Joe West and the terrible umpiring he's done in his career because that just overshadowed everything. But yeah, in that case, it was just like Joe Kelly. The Astros wound up scoring the go-ahead run that inning because during his performance, and that strike would have probably changed things. But yeah, that was an interesting game. Balls and strikes wise, it literally looked like the strike zone was just somebody clicked it with a mouse on the broadcast, moved it a little bit over to the right, and then suddenly Justin Verlander just couldn't get a pitch inside of that rectangle. Yeah. And like they were close enough to call strikes, but it was just there were some inconsistencies. And at the end of the day, that's the biggest problem, I think, with a home plate umpire is not calling the same zone the entire game. And that's obviously people had a problem with that.
And I think that's why Alex Cora got ejected, because I was watching for the little bit. It was a big spot in the game. And was it Benintendi who was up? It was Benintendi who was up, and I think the bases were loaded, or the Red Sox had a chance to take the lead, and Verlander threw 97 on the black. I mean, you look at the replay, and it literally split the outside corner. But that was a pitch that hadn't been getting called, and then all of a sudden, up goes the arm, you know, and Benintendi walks back to the. That's why Cora got so mad, is because you're right, that pitch hadn't been a strike all game, and then all of a sudden, in this huge spot, it is. And that's why you have people calling for robot umpires and, you know, letting computers do it. I think the technology is getting close to being there for that to happen. I think there are still inconsistencies with how the electronics call balls and strikes. I don't know that it's 100% perfect. And you really, if you're going to basically kick umpires out from behind the plate, you need it to be perfect. It has to be right. So I think that's part of the problem, is that they don't have it exactly 100% right. But we're not far off from that, Justin. Do you think we're getting close to that? And is that something you'd want to see, is just automated balls and strike calls?
Well, I mean, this kind of goes into what we were just talking about. There is certainly a point where I would have said, absolutely, what's the harm in at least experimenting with that? And the harm is, we were just talking about what the value is in having a human being out there doing it, that even when they get it wrong, sometimes that's just like, that's part of the game. And like as a fan, that's a form of, that makes it more entertaining, I suppose. There's like an entertainment component to the satisfaction you feel of knowing that call is locked in. This is why it's tough for me to talk about anything anymore, because I feel like I'm trying to be on each side of every debate, and it leads to a pretty scattered commentary. But in this case, Joe West makes me not want to sympathize with the umpires, because Joe West cites in a profile of him last year after he called his like 5,000th game, which again is an absolute absurdity given how many complaints he's had logged against him over the years. But in any case, that he cited an umpire from back in the day who was shown a picture of a call that he had called out, but the runner was clearly safe in the image. And he said something like, gentlemen, he was out because I said he was out. And like, that's the bullshit.
What a turd. Come on, man.
That's nothing. And that's what always confuses and honestly humors me about umpires, is that there's this like air of such superiority and honor. Like they do some sort of extremely important job. But we're sitting here talking about like, not could they be replaced by umpires, but okay, is it time, or could they be replaced by robots, but is it time to replace them with the robots yet that could easily do their jobs? And after games like that, it's like, yeah, I absolutely want to see what a robot can do in that situation. There would obviously be complications and issues far beyond just the technological component to it. But guys like Joe West make you want to try. Guys like Angel Hernandez really make you want to try. And Angel Hernandez is a bad umpire. Joe West is like a kind of a like crappy guy. One of the stories I mentioned in this article in Joe West was earlier this season. He suddenly just decided to have a problem with the cameras in the camera well at Chase Field. And he was just like chewing out these cameramen because the lenses of their television cameras were sticking over the ledge of the camera well. Like, has anyone ever had a problem with anything like that in baseball before? I mean, maybe, but you can't tell me he really cared about that. It just reminds you of all the like the worst teachers you ever had growing up. The ones who were like, they weren't stern, but fair. Like they weren't like there to educate you and just weren't, they didn't have a sense of humor about it. Cause even they like could be a good teacher. It's just the ones who came in and just decided that this was the thing they were going to focus on today. I remember at one point my school got really antsy about everybody, the locks on everybody's lockers. Like that was you're going to have detention if it's not like, if you don't have a lock, you got to know how to use it, blah, 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 blah. And then like, you know, the next semester that just wasn't a thing anymore. And with Joe West, it's like a night to night basis. What's going to be his hot button issue tonight? Well, and that's inconsistency on a broader level. And it makes him not just a bad umpire, but like a crappy guy to be around.
Or remember at the end, beginning of September when the whole thing with Austin Davis's cheat sheet, Davis is using this cheat sheet and Joe West walks over, you know, from third base and comes over and, you know, asks what Austin Davis has in his hand. He shows it to me and just takes it.
Yeah.
Just takes his cheat sheet. I couldn't believe.
He said, I didn't know what the rule was, so I just took it. And
so
like,
I just took it.
That's the absolute, if you don't know what the rule is, then you don't change the situation. You just leave it alone, find out what the rule is and adhere to it next time. There was a moment where I forget, it was a couple of years ago. I wish I had it in front of me, but there was a home run that needed to be reviewed and they wanted to review it. And Joe S was like, no, I don't want to review it. So we're not going to review it. And like he wasn't even like, yeah, it was a home run. I saw it. He was just like, no, I don't want to do that. So we're not going to.
Well, I mean, this is where we're at. So, like, you know, it kind of bring on the robots. And I know the umpires union. And I think, you know, I don't know enough about Peter Gammon's tweet about, you know, developing umpires and whether or not baseball is doing that well enough. I do know that there are some of these guys that are being protected and shouldn't be. They should be. We should know how good these umpires are. We should know a little bit more about their job performance.
Absolutely.
You know that they have data on these guys.
How can we find out so much information about players regarding stats, regarding their like shameful personal histories as we've seen this year? Like how can we find all of that information about the players with a few clicks of the mouse or a few scrolls on your phone? But the umpires are just this like bizarre mystery society that just gets to get away with everything. I don't know if you saw earlier this season, but Deadspin ran an article, like a pretty involved story about basically an umpiring conspiracy that got kicked off in Philadelphia. And I wish this was fresh on my mind at one point, and I unfortunately I'm starting to forget the details. But they ran this story about basically a guy who an umpire, his name was Steve Fields, and it had to do with the umpires being on strike, and Steve Fields like crossed over, and he earned the ear of this entire union of umpires. And there was an incident in a game where a bunch of Phillies players like Larry Boa and Dallas Green were like in this umpire's face, and the other umpires like didn't help him out or anything. And a Philadelphia area reporter like went up to him after the game and was like, how do you feel about the umpires not coming to your aid? And the other umpires like jumped on this guy, on this reporter, and like broke one of the lights of their production set, threw the camera to the ground. Like ridiculous stuff you would expect from like people trying to cover up a global conspiracy, not like baseball crimes, which again, like, could they even go to jail for something on that level? Like, that's absurd.
Yeah. No, that's just crazy. It's a whole other world that we don't know anything about. And I think Peter Gammons is right. There needs to be a little bit of a spotlight shown on this and improvement. Just improve, guys. It doesn't seem like there's a lot being done to try and improve the job performance of umpires. So we'll see if they get in any more trouble here as the playoffs roll on. Still a lot of playoffs left to go here in 2018. Let's talk a little bit more about the playoffs. We're going to get into some Philly stuff here in just a few minutes, but a couple other things about the postseason I kind of wanted to mention. And we're seeing a lot more in the playoffs right now, the overt use of bullpenning here, Justin. We know the Brewers have done it a bunch. The Brewers have the worst starting rotation of any of the teams in the playoffs. I think even coming into the postseason – I don't know, maybe the A's. I think the A's may have had a worse starting rotation than the Brewers did. But the A's went with a bullpen game in their wild card game against the Yankees, and that didn't work out. The Brewers did the same, I think, in their wild card game. It did work out for them, but the Brewers once again went with an all-bullpen game. In game one of the National League Championship Series, they had Gio Gonzalez, their starter, started the game, but they only had him in for two innings, and then they went with the bullpen for the rest of the game. And Gio didn't get hit around. I think he went two scoreless, but the plan was for Gio to go two innings and then to get him out of there. And in game two, you had Zach Davies go 5 1/3 innings and pitch pretty well. But the Dodgers said, you know, we got a long look at that bullpen in game one. We felt pretty good about our ability to hit them in game two. You know, that's all well and good because they can say that because they did hit the bullpen. You know, they can say that because they were able to get some hits and put some runs on the board in game two against that bullpen. But the art of bullpenning in and of itself just rubs me the wrong way, Justin. I love the fact that in games one and game two of the American League Championship Series, you had Justin Verlander versus Chris Sale. In game two, you had David Price versus Gerrit Cole. That's, to me, is what I look forward to in a playoff game. You know, I want to see these two great, and if you sometimes you don't have the horses to do that. The Brewers have Julie Chassin is probably their best starting pitcher. So they don't really have a marquee guy to match up against Clayton Kershaw. So I understand the Brewers have to do whatever they have to do, but I'm just not wild about the idea of bullpenning in postseason games, especially if it's part of a planned out strategy, you know, from midseason on. It doesn't seem like the Brewers really put any emphasis on improving the starting rotation in a major way because they knew they had such a good bullpen. It makes the playoffs less fun for me. And maybe that's old school of me. I realize it probably is. It's just, you know, I like the starting pitcher mentality, and I'm worried we're losing that, man. What do you think?
It doesn't make you old school or new school to disagree or agree. If you aligned with only one consistent line of thought, then you would be old school or new school. It shouldn't really like affect you're looking at something that's not pleasant and hasn't worked and saying, why are we still doing this? Like, that doesn't make you any particular school. That makes you a rational person. And that's what makes it so confusing. Like, what can you show? I'm not saying there isn't one. I'm genuinely curious. Do you know of an example of a time this season, maybe this postseason, where a bullpen game like that turned out to be the right move? That was like good. That was the right move. Like, came through in the clutch. Because a bullpen game, our understanding past few years is like, we don't have a starting pitcher for today, or like this yeah. is like this game doesn't matter. The Phillies are, you know,
it's usually a last resort
right.
sort
exactly.
of thing. I think the Astros last year, it wasn't that they set out at the beginning of a game to have a bullpen game, but there are a couple instances, especially in Game 7 of the World Series, where they brought Charlie Morton in like the third inning, but then Morton finished the rest of the mm-hmm. game. You know, they didn't go two innings here, one inning here, two innings here. I would imagine that there have been games where teams have won by getting a great performance from their bullpen when somebody gets knocked out early. But I can't remember a specific instance where a team came in and said, even though everybody's healthy, we are planning on just going with matchups and using 7 to 8 different pitchers today in order to try and win this game. That's just, I can't remember a game where that has worked. It did work for the Brewers in game one of the NLCS. They won that game. They shut the Dodgers down. Until the later innings, the Dodgers made a comeback very late. But, you know, it did work in game one for the Brewers. And then in game two, Davies did pitch into the sixth inning, but the bullpen blew it in the latter innings in a more traditional sense, when they were utilized in a more traditional sense. So you're right. I can't recall. And there may be times, and if any of our listeners listening to this can think of any times when it has worked that we're not remembering, you can tweet me at John Stolness. You can tweet Justin at Justin_Clue. Let us know, because I'm not thinking of one. Right now.
Honestly feel like, and I remember that. Yeah. Because it wasn't until I saw the stat, last night, that when Josh Hader left the game, since then the Brewers relievers had thrown 10 innings and given up 8 runs, and that had just like the tide had turned. Things that had worked weren't working. A couple of guys were giving up hits, giving up walks, not getting the calls, giving up runs when they hadn't before. So like on its surface, the idea of a team being like, you know, we have a pretty great bullpen. What if we just went to a 6-man rotation and the sixth pitcher was our bullpen? Or like in a playoff game, like our strength is not our rotation, but our bullpen is a strength. What if we just leaned on that the entire time? On the surface, it's like, hey, man, that's, you know, sounds like a pretty modern, wonky baseball idea, but let's give it a shot and see what happens, because experimentation is the key to evolution. And maybe if it worked, they kind of changed how people looked at baseball or looked at playoff series. And maybe it changes who gets into the playoffs, because a team with a good bullpen but a weak starting rotation might have a different way to go about things. But in the case that we're seeing, the problem with that plan is a bullpen is comprised of so many moving parts. And I feel like I say this all the time, but on a different topic, which is like, what's going to be the strength of a team next year? What's projected to be a strength of a team? A bullpen is the part of the team that changes the most every year. Like there's mostly guys out there.
It's most volatile.
Yeah, there's mostly guys out there who are on 1 or 2 year deals, who are like the team acquired for a bargain rather than because they wanted him particularly. You know, and you're making additions to that that can go pretty much under the radar. And even just from the concept that it's made up of multiple humans, a lot more has to go right for a bullpen game to work out. Like you have one pitcher go out there with the intention of pitching the whole game. He's going to prepare himself mentally. He's going to get himself up for that. And when you have a guy like Roy Halladay go out there, whose goal is to get everyone out until the end of the game, especially in that high pressure situation. I mean, that's what those guys live for. That's what they want to do. So he leaves the mound after the end of the inning. He knows he's going right back out. You have like six different guys who've got to do that every game, who aren't used to pitching very long, who aren't as prolific a pitcher. Like their job is to just get three outs and leave. Okay. But at the same time, that it doesn't take long for the pressure to get to you or to completely unravel. As we saw, it was Jeffers the other night pitching for Milwaukee when things started to go south and the umpires weren't giving him the close calls. And then I forget who came in after him, but he couldn't clean up the mess. And like,
it was Corey Knebel.
Yeah, that can strike. That can happen. And if it's your starting pitcher, you go out there, you check on him, you get somebody else up maybe if things are going really south. But it just seems so much more likely to happen when there's so many other moving parts in play, when you're switching pitchers every inning or every couple of innings or every matchup, you know. And you might have a bigger bullpen because it's your playoff roster. But at the same time, it just seems like when things are going right, sure, they're going right. But things can go wrong at any time. And you can't just throw bullpen arm, you know, bodies at the problem. Sometimes it's just, a guy enters the game with runners on second and third and no outs. And he's just like, damn it. Like, how did I get into this situation? This isn't my fault.
No, relievers are volatile. We know that relievers are. We saw with even the Phillies bullpen this year for a month and a half, 2 months, they were lights out. And then for a lot of the other parts of the season, they were unreliable, especially late in games. We saw it with Sir Anthony Dominguez as a rookie. We saw Tommy Hunter last year with was dynamite against left-handers with his cutter this year. He was just missing location all year and got absolutely beat to death by left-handers. And when you've got 4, 5, 6, 7 different pitchers, that's a lot more arms. There's a lot more margin for error, like you mentioned, that can go wrong when you've got all those different guys. That's a great point about bullpenning. And we're going to see it more in this postseason, and we'll kind of see how it works. I still think that having a strong starting rotation with a good selection of relievers at the back of the bullpen is the smartest way to go about putting together a pitching staff. And sometimes you gotta, you know, when you're a small market team like the A's and the Brewers, you gotta dance with the girl that brung you, and you gotta do the best you can with it. And so, you know, I know Craig Counsell is gonna just kind of try and, you know, get through it game by game and use the guys he has. And, you know, it's 1-1. It's still a long series, so we'll see what happens there in the NLCS. And I don't think we'll see as much of it with Houston and Boston, considering those two teams both have pretty darn good starting rotations. Let's move on. Let's quickly. One other thing I wanted to mention about the postseason, we'll link this to the Phillies so we can kind of get into some Philly stuff as well. We saw the Dodgers in game two of the NLCS go with the strategy of using their starters for one or two at-bats and then pinch hitting for them as soon as Milwaukee changed pitchers, which is exactly what Gabe Kapler did with the Phillies in August and September when we were kind of trying to figure out, why are you starting Justin Bour with the intention of only giving him one or two plate appearances? You know, what was the, what's the thinking behind that, where you're going into the game knowing that you're going to take out one of your starters in the fourth or the fifth inning because you're expecting to score a bunch of runs with him. And then when they get the start, when they knock the starter out early, they bring somebody else in, you swap that guy out. It just seemed like you're making a lot of assumptions that you're going to be able to do things that you're not, may not necessarily be able to do. And I think the key here, Justin, is that maybe it wasn't so much that Kapler's ideas were crazy, because the Dodgers are doing it. We've seen other teams doing it. Obviously, Kapler came from the Dodgers. A lot of what the Dodgers are doing, the philosophy was in place while Kapler was there. So a lot of what he's doing with the Phillies and trying to make work with the Phillies is stuff that the Dodgers are doing. It's just the Dodgers have a loaded roster, so it probably works a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying a version of that. I think that's kind of the argument when it's like, fire Kapler. It's like, well, I could see how that makes sense.
Yeah, it just didn't work.
And I certainly see how I certainly see where impatience and frustration comes from. We all felt it at various points. But yeah, I mean, that's the counter argument, that Gabe Kapler just didn't have the toolbox to play the kind of baseball he was trying to play, which you could say, once you realize that, which before the end of the season, you could certainly realize that maybe you alter your strategy, but it didn't get altered. He just kept trying to, you know, hammer a screw into the wall. And eventually that stopped being an effective strategy to build anything. So, you know, at the end of the season, it didn't even look like Gabe Kapler was successfully getting the players interested in playing baseball anymore. So, yeah, I mean, it is an argument. There's an argument to be made that maybe with better players, with players more suited to Gabe Kapler, what Gabe Kapler's, the way he's trying to manage, as in like the Dodgers, you know, maybe that means he's more successful as a manager. And sure, there's plenty of merit to that. Question is, at this point, is Gabe Kapler, do you want to build the team around Gabe Kapler? Because the Phillies have all these prospects that they traded for, they traded key pieces for, that they developed and they brought up. And now, you know, we watch them all in action with the new manager, and there seemed to be a disconnect there for at least a significant part of the season. Is Gabe Kapler the guy you want to start molding the team around? Because we've seen a version of this work. But just because it works with Dave Roberts and the Dodgers doesn't mean it's going to work with Gabe Kapler and the Phillies, even with the right players installed. So is he really the one you want to mold the team around? And that's kind of the decision I think they're at this point. I don't think any of us are surprised that Gabe Kapler's coming back for another season based on, you know, the level of humiliation the team would have faced hiring him, firing him, even after he was, you know, a manager of the year contender for the beginning part of the season. So, yeah, I think that's a question you got to ask. And, you know, it's difficult to answer, because if these aren't the right players, who are and how do you get them? So, yeah, I think it. Yeah,
that's what the offseason's all about, buddy. You know what I mean? Like
no one's arguing. Well, people are arguing, but there's certainly a conclusion to be drawn that that style of managing can work. And yes, the Dodgers are doing that. But it doesn't mean that necessarily Gabe Kapler is the key to it working here. We'll see if that's true. And it's certainly possible that it is, but you can't, the way that that's smarmily being stated as the end all be all proof that what Gabe Kapler does works, the team is just wrong. I mean, geez, do you really want to blame the Phillies, the end of the Phillies season on 25 players and not include the manager in that? Like, no one's hands are clean here.
Correct. No. Yeah, this is not a statement of saying, you know, everything Gabe Kapler did was right. The only thing I think that, you know, needs to be kind of beaten back a little bit is that Gabe Kapler is reinventing baseball and doing things that we've never seen before. And that's not the case.
No.
What has made Gabe Kapler so unique, I think, is how he talks about baseball, is how he interacts with baseball, how he interacts with fans, how he interacts with the media, kind of, I don't necessarily, and you know, it's new to Philadelphians, all this, you know, all this analytics, how they're utilizing, you know, different players and rosters and all this kind of stuff. It's new to us. And so, you know, that's the issue here, is that it's new to us. It's not necessarily new to baseball. And that's the only thing, reason why I wanted to bring it up, is like, hey guys, this is being done in other places successfully. Doesn't mean that Gabe Kapler is always right. It doesn't mean that he's going to be here for the next decade. Maybe he will be. And once they have better players, a lot of these different things that they were doing will work. We also know that the team said that they were going to experiment a lot this year. They were trying some different things out, working on different things. Maybe they'll do this again next year when they have what we hope are better players, and maybe they won't do it as often. It seemed kind of odd when they were doing it with Justin Bour and Scott Kingery and moving Carlos Santana from third to first and Asdrubal Cabrera from shortstop to third, and you had all these different guys out of position doing all of these machinations. I think that was part of what made it seem a little bit
right,
weird.
Like, I get why this is supposed to work, but listen to those names you just said and the kind of seasons those guys were right. having. Like, you can't tell me, well, if I turn Scott Kingery towards this angle, he's going to be much better at playing out of position. Like, come on. I think that's a lot of people's argument is that it seemed like there was no common sense or gut instinct or looking at the players being utilized. It was just this is how it's supposed to work, so we're going to keep doing it this way.
Yeah, exactly. No, I know what you mean. There's still a lot of experimentation, a lot of work to go on, and we'll see what kind of roster Gabe Kapler has to work with next year. But Gabe Kapler is going to be the manager, and I know that some of us who have been wondering about the future of Gabe Kapler long-term, before Gabe was hired last year, the guy who a lot of fans wanted the team to hire was AAA manager Dusty Wathan, who spent last year with the team as the third base coach. Found out this week, Justin, he interviewed for the Rangers job, and I don't know how you feel about Dusty Wathan potentially leaving the team. Didn't hear a lot from him this season. He didn't talk very much. I thought he did a fine job coaching third base. I can't remember him being a lightning rod of criticism necessarily, one or really noticeable one way or the other. We know that he had a relationship with virtually all the young players that came through the system, as he was their manager for the Iron Pigs over the last couple of years as they passed through. But obviously this is Gabe's team, and I really do wonder what this would do for the locker room if Dusty Wathan leaves. Does this, without knowing exactly what the locker room is kind of like, you know, I will say this about the players. You don't hear a lot of effusive praise from the players for Gabe Kapler. You don't hear a lot of, Gabe's my guy. I'm riding behind Gabe 100%. Rhys Hoskins at the end of the season said Gabe's, I think he used the word unique three times to describe Gabe Kapler, and said some positive things about him. He'll always tell you what's going on, but he's unique. But he always, you know, he's always willing to accept criticism, but Gabe's, you didn't come out and say anything along the lines of Gabe's my guy or anything like that. And I haven't heard really any of the Phillies players say anything like that. And I don't know how much of that is because maybe they still have an affection for Dusty Wathan. I don't know. I wondered that before the season, whether or not having Dusty on the major league staff would cause a little bit of friction. Not even friction necessarily, but a little bit of, you know, these players, they played under Dusty Wathan. They're comfortable with Dusty, and they've got Gabe Kapler there, but Dusty's in the room too. I thought it might have made for a little bit of a weird dynamic, and now we'll see what happens. I don't know if he's the leading candidate for the Rangers job, but what do you make about Dusty Wathan potentially leaving for Texas? Would it make you nervous if he wasn't around?
Well, I mean, it would make me more nervous if he had established more of a presence this season. And by that, I mean a presence enough that you and I were aware of the impact he was having, on the team. Like you said, we did not hear a lot from him. The general assumption has been that, he was there because a lot of the players he's been coaching in Lehigh Valley were on the team now. So, He interviewed and did not get the Phillies managing position, but having him there was something of a, not a consolation prize for him, but something of an asset to, like, look, you know, I know these players. You know, Gabe Kapler, you're from entirely outside the organization. And he did get the job. Wathan was, who is, by the way, like, infamously positive, much like the Phillies' current manager. He just happens to also have a history with a lot of the guys mm-hmm. who are playing, especially this year, who are in spots where we were learning where they were going to, where they sat with the team now and in the future. So losing him, I guess it would be a sign that the Phillies feel like the training wheels are off in a way. Not that he's the training wheels all by himself, but it would certainly signify, I think, something to that end, that like, all right, look, we can give Kepler a few less handlers, I suppose. Gave him a terrific bench coach in Rob Thomson, who was with the Yankees for so long and was with Joe Girardi for so long and has all this experience serving in exactly the role the Phillies hired him to be in. But in the case of Wathan, yeah, I mean, he's 44 years old. He's probably not going to be here, you know, until the end of his career, especially if he doesn't move into a more prominent position. So about now is when you'd expect to see him start, you know, looking at other roles outside of the organization. But again, if we had more players saying like, oh yeah, having Dusty here is really important, it's really crucial, we can assume that's the case, because again, he's worked so well and so often with so many of them, especially as we learned about these players, as we learned Rhys Hoskins was tearing it up in the International League, even with Dylan Cousins, as we learned about Nick Williams' development behaviorally, but also as a player, it was under Dusty Wathan. And there is some value, whether we know about it or not, to him being in there and having a relationship with these Phillies. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it came down to the Phillies just wanting to really throw a whole new angle on things. Obviously, maybe the new front office with its focus more on modernizing their approach to development, maybe Bill Kepler, but also keeping Wathan running, aware of the value he has. So him taking that job, it would be interesting to see how he does with the Rangers. But it would also be more interesting, I think, to see the impact it has on the locker room, because he's somebody who was there for a reason. And with that, you know, if that reason wasn't important enough to try and keep him around or for him to feel like he needed to be around, then, you know, good luck, guys. Let's see what happens.
Well, and he hasn't gotten the job yet. He will. It's probably more likely than not that that he'll come back to the Phillies this for the 2019 season. So again, I thought last year it would have made for kind of an interesting locker room, and I wondered whether or not players would be torn between their old manager and their new manager, and whether that would cause some uneasiness with Gabe Kapler, you know, whether or not having this guy around would cause him to feel uneasy. But I doubt that that's the case with Gabe. I think Cap is probably just more like, you know, hey, this is, you know, I don't, whatever, you know, I don't really think he really felt like Dusty Wathan was a threat. But, you know, certainly with Gabe Kapler's, whatever you may think of his job security, it seems as though Dusty would be the next in line if something were to happen. If they were to decide to make a decision with Kapler, that Dusty would be the next in line. And if Dusty were to go, then the Phillies would basically have to ride Kapler anyway, which I think is probably what they want to do. I don't know that the trigger would necessarily be quicker with Kapler if Dusty was or wasn't around. I don't know that that factors into it really at all, but it might, you know, it could. I don't know. It's definitely interesting. We'll see whether or not Dusty gets the job. Couple other things before we wrap up here, Justin. Just kind of looking ahead at 2019 a little bit. We've talked a lot about the offseason, potential free agents, potential trades, and all that kind of stuff. I really think they have a couple interesting decisions to make with the starting rotation. I think they have five guys that they could roll into next year with. They could go with Nola, Arrieta, Velasquez, Pivetta, and Eflin again. They pitched well enough for about 4 months off and on. Anybody named Aaron Nola had definitely had their ups and downs, but for the most part, the starting rotation was pretty good for the first 4 months of the season. It was the last 2 months where things kind of went a little bit sideways on them. So you probably could go into next year in the starting rotation staying the way it is. I think I would like to see them bring in someone who's a little bit more stable. I recommended in the last podcast trying to trade for Madison Bumgarner, who I would think the Giants would be stupid not to be looking to move this offseason and try to rebuild. He's in the last year of his contract. I also like the fact it looks like the Yankees are looking to move Sonny Gray, and with Didi Gregorius going under Tommy John surgery, if they don't want to go after Manny Machado and they're just kind of looking for something maybe shorter term that doesn't have as much of a commitment in terms of years and in terms of money. An interesting trade proposal in my mind is Cesar Hernandez for Sonny Gray. I think Cesar would allow them to play Gleyber Torres at shortstop, which is his natural position. You have Cesar for a year. You can move on from Cesar after next year if you want to. He's only going to cost you $8 or $9 million. And, you know, for better or worse, Cesar is a decent player. He might actually play a little bit better in New York given that short porch in right field. Who knows? But really, it looks like the Yankees kind of just want to get rid of Sonny Gray, who has great stuff. The peripherals are always really good with Sonny Gray, but at the end of the day, the ERA is always high. He seems to get hit around a lot. He doesn't seem to know exactly what he's doing. I'm not sure the Yankees are using him in the right way. All that being said, there are ways, there are things that the Phillies could do to change up their starting rotation next year, which means you'd have to figure out something to do with Velasquez, Pivetta, and Eflin. So I'm going to ask you a question on these three guys and tell me what you think. Which of these three pitchers would you trade? Which one would you convert to the bullpen? And which one would you leave as a starter?
Okay. This is okay. I'm very intense. Go ahead.
Very intense. Yeah, lock it down. You want me to go first?
Yeah. I definitely want to hear yours first.
Okay. All right. Let me go first here. The three of these pitchers I have the least confidence in is Eflin. So I would look to trade Eflin. I was really surprised when I had Jim Salisbury on the podcast a couple weeks ago. He seemed to have the most confidence in Eflin, which I thought was interesting. I'm not sure that I see the same thing that other people see in Eflin. I see a slightly better fastball that was enabling him to get some more swings and misses in the strike zone, but I don't see any breaking stuff from Zach Eflin that really makes me stand up. When I look at Velasquez and when I look at Pivetta, I see stuff that is way better than Eflin. And so if I'm going to trade any one of these three guys, I also don't think Eflin really works as a reliever. So I would probably look to trade Zach Eflin. The pitcher that I would probably move into the bullpen, I would probably go with Nick Pivetta to move Pivetta to the bullpen, because I think there's a couple times this year where they used him as a reliever in emergency situations, and he's got the kind of stuff I think that works really well the first time through the order. His fastball could be even more dominant. He could just be a fastball curveball guy out of the bullpen and be an unbelievable late inning reliever. Whereas I think Velasquez, I'm not sure I see Velasquez is as good an option out of the bullpen as Pivetta. I would leave Velasquez in the starting rotation. Because I think, you know, with the exception of a really bad September, I think Velasquez really stepped up this year. Going into September, if you threw out the 10 run game that he had against the Brewers, he had an ERA of like 3.8. I mean, that's really good. And he was pitching deeper into games, still getting a ton of strikeouts. I also believe if he had a better defense behind him, and I believe this for all three guys, for everybody in the rotation, if they had a better defense behind him, all of their numbers would have looked better. But Velasquez would be the guy I'm keeping in the starting rotation. Pivetta is the guy I'm moving to the bullpen. Eflin is the guy I'm looking to trade.
All right. I think I can agree with you on Eflin. He's the one I'm least excited about. Of course, that means he's probably also the one you're going to get less for in a trade. So I don't think it's a trade we're really looking for to use to build. It's more of a trade to clear space in his case. Whereas I think for somebody like Velasquez, you might be able to get something a little more interesting than what you'd get for Eflin. However, I think the way you're aligning is probably the correct take. But just to spice things up, I'd switch it around and put Velasquez in the bullpen and keep Pivetta as a starter. I wouldn't be excited about keeping Pivetta in the starting rotation, but I think it would give him a chance to increase on the success he did have this season. There were points when acquiring him for Jonathan Papelbon seemed like the steal of the century, back when it seemed like he was going to be an effective pitcher. So giving him a chance to expand on that, I think, would.
I think it still is, Justin. That's still an amazing trade.
I mean, getting rid of Jonathan Papelbon will always be a very valuable thing. This team.
But I think there's so much promise in that arm, too. I mean, the fact that, yes, you were able to just get rid of a guy no one ever thought you'd be able to get rid of. But to get a guy with stuff like that, where you know there's something there, he's either going to be a good starter or a good relief pitcher. One of those two things is true.
You could honestly argue that the success he has had already is enough to make the trade a steal from the
Absolutely, totally, 100% agree. Just like the Ken Giles trade, mm-hmm. I think is already good enough, given what you've already gotten out of Velasquez. You know, I think Velasquez has already given you enough as a starting pitcher to make that Ken Giles trade a success.
I think if you're clearing space in the rotation to acquire, you know, Sonny Gray or some version of Sonny Gray, get genuine upgrades at pitching and not somebody like Sonny Gray that you're like, well, okay, let's fiddle with him.
Like a Bumgarner, you know, like a Keuchel or something like that, right.
And you suddenly have a top of the rotation with Aaron Nola, you know, this newly acquired pitcher, presumably Jake Arrieta is some better form of Jake Arrieta at some point and not the guy who was having bad games pretty regularly through the second half of the season. That's, you know, and you suddenly put stack Nick Pivetta behind them in like the 4 or 5 slot, which is the only thing his ceiling has ever been anyway. And just give him another chance to figure things out. I think that's a move that doesn't make no sense, but it's also the move I'm making because I'm very interested to see Vince Velasquez, come out of the bullpen, because out of the three of them, I think Vince Velasquez has the most overpowering stuff. Of those three arms, he's an absolute flamethrower, and I think we saw some downticks in velocity a couple times this season. But mm-hmm. he also took steps forward this year, and I think his biggest problem is that in the early innings, you know, he's throwing like 50 pitches in every start, and he's not making it to the end anyway. So if you have him in a position where he has to pitch less, he's an emotional guy. He just seems like more of a reliever, and that having to come out maybe in a higher pressure situation, but for a shorter amount of time might do him good. Of course, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean he's cutting down on the amount of pitches he can throw. He can still throw 25 pitches in an inning if he's only pitching one inning, but it also increases the chance that he comes out there, throws the absolute living hell out of the ball. And you know, mows down three hitters, pretty quickly and gets you out of a jam. So I think he's a guy I've always, he's had some success this year. He's somebody I've always been interested in seeing come out of the bullpen. And I honestly thought that they would have made that move already. But the success he's had this year, you know, it was encouraging.
Yeah, and I'm throwing out the September because that was the most innings he'd ever thrown. Mm-hmm. And really, I'm kind of throwing out the September for all of the pitchers because they had surpassed innings totals already by that point, and we could all kind of see it coming. And you're right, but how many times this year did we see Velasquez come out and look like absolute gangbusters in the first inning, where just blowing people away with his fastball, striking out the side on 10 or 11 pitches, and maybe even for the first two innings coming out looking like absolute fire. And then in the third or the fourth inning, he would kind of fall apart a little bit, give up two or three runs here and there, and then he'd recover a little bit. I mean, I think he did a much better job recovering this year, and with pitch economy, I think he did a much better job with pitch economy this year. He was more reliable, but I guess the bottom line for me is having Velasquez and Pivetta in the same rotation is just a little bit dangerous because both of these guys are erratic and a little bit unreliable. Now, they're both young too, so does some of that erraticness, does some of that unreliability go away next year with another year of experience, with a little bit more time under their belt to understand what the league is all about, pitching against the lineup the second and the third time through the order? Maybe that changes a little bit, but I do think there were too many nights, especially in the latter half of the season, the last third of the season, where with Velasquez and Pivetta and Eflin, you just weren't getting enough length out of any of those guys. And so having all of them back next year, it might just be a little bit too big of a roll of the dice if you want to be a division contender.
Honestly, while we were talking, I brought up Velasquez's stats from this year, and his ERA in the first inning is his best inning ERA except for the sixth. So it's just his second best. Sorry, that was misleading. But but yeah.
Like you misled me.
He can come out and you know, put on a show for you. And I think that's an excellent point that at the end of the day, you can't have these three guys back in your rotation next year and expect to see marketed improvement from the get go. Yeah. I think chances were given, you know, season, we've seen enough of in some cases that moving on, I'm not talking about callously, you know, kicking somebody to the curb, because that's not what it would be anymore. It would be moving on after seeing what a guy is capable of. And, you know, maybe there's a chance they find success somewhere else. But at this point, this team needs to improve in too many places to trot the same guys out there and think maybe this time with the right adjustments, we can get more from these three pitchers. I don't think that you need to get rid of all of them, but you're absolutely right. Having them all in the same rotation again would probably be a mistake.
Well, Justin, I think that's a mighty fine hitting season podcast we put together, my friend. Any final thoughts before we get out of here? You've been doing a lot of other writing, extra writing for other spots. I want you to kind of just tell everybody real quick, you know, who else are you doing some writing for now? You mentioned Baseball Prospectus just a minute ago, and for folks who haven't checked out some of your stuff there, please do. It's really awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing the Short Relief, which is the weekly sort of baseball ancillary columns that they have a lot of really talented writers doing over there, excluding me. And then I'm also doing the their playoff recaps, which are they follow the same kind of theme. It's less about like who was hitting when and what happened in the game, and more about harping on a particular event or aspect of the game or the narrative, and just writing about that. And it's given a lot of writers a lot of leeway to explore some more interesting ideas than the kind of stuff you see in a general recap. But it's given me a chance in the NLDS to write about the uptick in hugging we were seeing in a lot of the games, in the middle
big storyline.
And then in the ALCS, I got to write about Joe West and getting hit by the ball and his general way of being himself. I also wrote a story on for the Hardball Times for Fangraphs, more narrative.
That's right.
On a brewery in Baltimore that's been built on the grounds of Old Oriole Park and across the street from another one of Old Oriole Park, where Babe Ruth used to play, and just sort of the job they're doing in a city where baseball really kind of died on the professional level this year, and how they, as like upkeepers of the baseball legacy in Baltimore, and the job that they've had to do to really keep that aspect of the city's history alive. So it's been some cool stuff, but we're also looking forward to the Good Fight this off season. We're gonna have a lot of great stuff. Certainly our season in review stuff is going to come up soon, and we have a lot of people really primed to cover ground in what will be a really interesting off season. So obviously stay tuned to that as well.
Absolutely. And stay tuned to this podcast and continued success and the Dirty Inning, because we do have hopefully what we expect is going to be a really, really fun off season ahead of what we hope are a lot of Phillies moves that will improve this team for 2019. And make sure that you have subscribed to the Good Fight podcast feed to make sure you're getting all of those podcasts. I will have the Phillies, my weekly Phillies newsletter out for the Patreon. Make sure you go to patreon.com/hittingseason, and you can find some bonus podcasts there. If you sign up on the $5 tier, you can get the newsletter. If you sign up on the $10 tier, as well as a bunch of other stuff. So make sure to check out patreon.com/hittingseason, and I'll have some the newsletter up there tomorrow morning or early tomorrow afternoon. That'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season, episode number 22. For Justin Clue, I'm John Stolness. Everybody have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you all later.
Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.